four commercial airliners took off on a Tuesday morning, carrying people thinking about business meetings, family visits, and vacation plans. Within 2 hours, all four planes had crashed. Nearly 3,000 people were dead, and America had entered a new era. September 11, 2001 didn't just kill, it divided time itself into before and after, transforming a nation that had felt invincible into one that understood its vulnerability. What makes this day so haunting isn't just the scale of destruction, but how swiftly normalcy shattered. Fathers kissed children goodbye at breakfast tables, never imagining those would be final embraces. Office workers grabbed morning coffee, unaware they'd soon face impossible choices between burning and falling. The attack succeeded not through sophisticated weaponry, but through exploiting the mundane. Box cutters that passed through security, commercial pilot training that taught terrorists to fly, and America's fundamental assumption that hijackers wanted to negotiate, not to die. Understanding September 11 requires more than knowing what happened. It demands remembering the human stories behind the statistics, the ordinary people thrust into extraordinary circumstances, and the moments when strangers became heroes simply by refusing to surrender. 3 years before 9/11, Osama bin Laden declared war on America. His February 1998 fatwa commanded Muslims to kill Americans and plunder their money wherever and whenever they find it. Yet America barely noticed. The New York Times had mentioned bin Laden in just 15 articles before the fatwa. A Gallup poll the day before the attacks found less than 1% of Americans considered terrorism pressing. Meanwhile, 19 men infiltrated the country, learning to fly commercial jets and planning to weaponize aircraft against iconic structures. Their luggage contained flight manuals, computers, knives, pepper spray, and martyrdom instructions. One side prepared methodically for battle, while the other worried about stock portfolios and weekend plans. America had been at war for years without realizing it, and that ignorance would prove devastatingly costly. Between 7:59 and 8:42 a.m., four planes departed carrying strategically positioned hijackers. At 8:14 a.m., flight attendant Betty Ong made a fateful call. "I think we're being hijacked." For 25 minutes, she calmly described stabbed passengers, a breached cockpit, and mace filling the cabin. Air traffic controller Peter Zaleski heard an accidental transmission, "We have some planes," plural. Yet crucial minutes evaporated before anyone contacted the military. Everyone assumed hijackers would make demands and land. Nobody imagined murdered pilots and terrorists flying the planes themselves. Passenger Peter Hansen called his father from United 175. "I think they intend to fly into a building." United Flight 93's 40-minute delay proved fateful. Passengers learned about the other attacks, transforming them from victims into fighters. By 9:03 a.m., when United 175 struck the South Tower live on television, America's understanding of terrorism had fundamentally changed. As hijacked planes approached their targets, America's defense infrastructure faltered. At the Northeast Air Defense Sector, Major Kevin Nassapenny initially thought hijacking reports were a training exercise. When he realized it's real world, he scrambled F-15 fighters, but they flew toward empty ocean while hijacked planes approached Manhattan. Post-Cold War budget cuts had reduced alert fighters from scores to just 14 nationwide. Disabled transponders made hijacked planes nearly invisible, and the FAA struggled with protocols designed for traditional hijackings, not suicide missions. President Bush learned of the first crash before entering a Florida classroom, initially assuming a small plane accident. When Chief of Staff Andy Card whispered, "America is under attack," at 9:05 a.m., Bush remained seated for 7 more minutes. FAA manager Ben Sliney, remarkably on his first day, took unprecedented action, ordering every aircraft to land immediately. At 9:37 a.m., Flight 77 struck the Pentagon. the most effective response came from ordinary citizens aboard Flight 93 who learned about the attacks through phone calls and voted to fight back, preventing terrorists from reaching Washington. Flight 93 passengers transformed from victims into fighters through phone calls revealing the broader attack. Mark Bingham called his mother with formal identification, "Mom, this is Mark Bingham," anchoring his identity one final time. Jeremy Glick, a former judo champion, discussed attacking hijackers while his mother-in-law coached, "Make him brave." Tom Burnett called his wife Dina multiple times, gathering intelligence and concluding the bomb threat was fake. His final words, "A group of us are getting ready to do something." Todd Beamer reached operator Lisa Jefferson, declining connection to his pregnant wife to avoid upsetting her. After reciting the Lord's Prayer together, his command became legend. "Let's roll." 100 feet separated them from the cockpit. They repurposed a beverage cart as a battering ram, advancing with fearsome yells. At 10:01 a.m., realizing Washington was unreachable, hijackers made their final decision. "Shall we pull it down?" The plane nosedived, flew sideways, then completely upside down. At 10:03 a.m., Flight 93 crashed near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, 20 minutes from the Capitol. All 40 aboard died, but their counterattack saved countless lives in the first battle of a new war. The Twin Towers had hidden flaws. Construction shortcuts included uncertain fireproofing, fewer stairwells than older buildings, and untested fire protection. When Flight 11 struck the North Tower at 8:46 a.m., it severed 35 columns and trapped 1,355 people above. The innovative tube-within-a-tube design redistributed loads to undamaged columns, allowing over 7,500 people below to evacuate while jet fuel fires weakened the steel. Brian Clark felt drawn to distant stairwell A, a choice that saved him when closer exits were destroyed. Descending past the 81st floor, he heard Stan Primnath crying for help. Before being rescued, Stan asked, "Do you believe in Jesus Christ?" Together, they escaped. Captain Jay Jonas and Ladder 6 encountered Josephine Harris, a 60-year-old with a bad leg. When the North Tower collapsed at 10:28 a.m., their slower pace positioned them perfectly to survive in an intact section of stairwell B. The woman they'd considered a burden had saved their lives, becoming Ladder 6's guardian angel. The South Tower fell first at 9:59 a.m., despite being hit second. The attacks claimed 2,977 lives from 90 countries. Brian Clark battled survivor's guilt. Ron Clifford realized stopping to help burn victim Jenny Ann Maffeo, a delay that seemed tragic, likely saved him from falling debris. "There's something else at work here," he reflected. Only 1,640 victims were identified. Over 1,100 families received no remains. The identification process continues as DNA technology advances. At Shanksville, coroner Wally Miller vowed to identify every Flight 93 passenger. The Pentagon rebuilt within a year, Rumsfeld declaring on September 11 itself, "It will be in business tomorrow." The attacks transformed America. New security measures, two wars, homeland security, 24/7 agency coordination. Yet the most enduring legacy is how ordinary people responded. Passengers fought back. Firefighters climbed toward danger. Strangers helped strangers down endless stairwells. Captain Jay Jonas reflected, "I was never so proud to be a fireman as I was that day." September 11 revealed both humanity's capacity for evil and its capacity for courage, that even when towers fall, the human spirit refuses to be conquered.